in my first year as priest, completing graduate studies out of the North American College, I had the occasion to celebrate Mass about a half dozen times in an entirely empty Basilica of St. Peter. It was during the Jubilee year, and almost every Sunday when there was a Mass outside in the square, they would close the Basilica. And so no priest, no faithful could get in. But because I was a guide for the Vatican's excavations office to St. Peter's tomb and was known to the Swiss guards, I was always able to pass by through the gate of the Holy Office and enter the Basilica through the sacristy. On most Sundays, most of the priests who worked for the Curia were out in various pastoral assignments, and none of the typical visiting priests could get in. So on those occasions, I was the only human being in the entire Basilica of St. Peter's. I would leave the sacristy, and I had my choice of every single altar in that basilica, with the exception of the papal altar, for which the candles weren't even lit. I could go down to St. Pius X, on whose altar I would normally celebrate during the week. You could go to St. Gregory the Great. You could go to St. Joseph at, whom the church will celebrate later this week. I could celebrate basically anywhere. But every time that happened, I went to the same altar. Not so much because I thought about it ahead of time, but because I felt drawn there. It was the altar built over the mortal remains of the saint we celebrate today, St. Leo the Great. I've always admired St. Leo for his eloquence. During my pre-theology years, I had read a few of his sermons on Christ's incarnation, and they moved me so much that I ended up gradually reading all 96 of his extant homilies and his 143 letters. I also loved him for his courage, the bravery that led him to face Attila the Hun face to face in 452 and divert this barbarian from his plans to pillage Rome the same way he had his armies despoil so many cities in northern Italy. I love the passion with which he defended our faith and sought the unity for which Christ prayed during the Last Supper. He fought against the heresies of Arianism, Pelagianism, Manichaeism, Priscillianism, Nestorianism, and Eutychism, precisely because he was fighting with all that he had for church unity. And I love the way his faith influenced his worship of God that could still be lived today. Whenever I would give tours of the Lateran baptistry, it was his poetry all around the eight sides of that baldachin over the second oldest baptismal font in the history of the church after the Jordan River. I loved going to St. Paul's outside the walls and seeing the triumphal arch, which was done under his pontificate, and he raised the money for it, and he put up the theology of the cross there, in which you see Jesus with all his humanity seen in his beard, risen from the dead with the cross the size basically of a bamboo pole, because his love made even that much suffering light and sweet. I loved when I would go over to St. Mary Major and you would look at the entire history of salvation leading from Abraham to Christ throughout the Basilica in those 5th century mosaics, all conceptualized by him in that great Joshua series, which dominated salvation history, not just because Jesus would be named after Joshua, Yeshua in Hebrew, but more importantly, because Joshua taught the Israelites and was trying to teach the Romans how to count on the power of God as the barbarians were on the move. All of it. I loved St. Leo, and I was drawn to celebrate at his altar over and over and over again. One aspect of St. Leo's life that I pondered a lot during the time when I was a seminarian was a famous mystical experience he had that can provide a powerful introduction to today's readings. At some point early in his papacy, as he thought about the weight of his office, he began to become somewhat frightened about all of the mistakes he was making, all his failings, even his sins. And he turned as a priest in Pope Ott in prayer to the Lord, And for 40 straight days he went to the tomb of his predecessor, St. Peter, begging the Lord for mercy through the power of the keys. And at the end of this lengthy novena, St. Peter appeared to him in a vision and told him that the Lord would be very merciful to him, with one exception. Except those sins, St. Peter told him, committed by you in conferring holy orders. Of these, you still remain charged to give a vigorous and rigorous account. The experience deeply affected Leo, and always left him with a sense of his duties to assure the worthiness of any priest or any bishop on whom he would lay hands. St. Leo would even compose and lay down a rule for the primitive canon law of the time, not to lay hands on anyone suddenly, according to the precept of the Apostle St. Paul, and not to raise to the honor of the priesthood any who have not been thoroughly tried, who are not of a mature age, who have not gone through a competent time of testing, who haven't exercised and earned the merit of labor in the service of the church, and who haven't given sufficient proofs of their obedience to rule, their love of discipline, and their zeal for its observance. I pondered this episode a lot because it's clear from this story how seriously the Lord Jesus takes the sacrament of holy orders, how seriously he wanted Leo to take it, and how seriously I believe he wants each of us to take it. It takes generations of priests to build up the faith, but it can take just one to destroy so many generations of priestly hard work. In some places during our age, certain segments of the church lost this clarity. There is a race in certain dioceses to be the first ordinary to ordain 100 men in a year. And some of the men ordained during those years were the ones who ended up on police blotters. Men were ordained who should never have been ordained. Some weren't mature enough for the priesthood. Others were never intending zealously to become diligent laborers, bringing in the Lord's urgent and white harvest of souls. Others were becoming ordained simply to please their moms, who always wanted a priest in the family. Others were using the priesthood to stay in the closet. Others, sad to say, were already living double lives. But the hands were coming down on them anyway. And then Rudy Koss happened. If you don't know who Rudy Koss was, I was a second-year theologian when his name became infamous. He was a priest in Dallas who was a terrible, notorious serial abuser, and he had a $117 million judgment against him for abuse. And the whole church woke up anew to what we should have never forgotten: the incredible duty of scrutinizing men and making sure no man gets to the holy order, to the holy altar, unless he has proven himself with the criteria that Leo himself had set down. Unless you were actively seeking holiness, unless you were a man of strength and asceticism, unless you were somebody truly docile to the Holy Spirit, unless you was a man living according to the qualities we talked about this morning. If one solitary priest could bankrupt a whole diocese, then bishops realized that everything had to change, and standards necessarily had to be higher. It opened the church anew to the fact that scandalous priests can cause enormous damage, far worse than 9-figure court decisions. Any retreat day. Whereas the imitation of Christ encourages any and every day, it's important for us to do what Leo did, to think about death, to turn to the Lord's mercy, and to begin to think seriously about the things that we're doing. For those of us in holy orders and preparing for holy orders, it's important for us to ponder how we're living in accordance with the gift and the supreme spiritual calling we've been given. Today's readings help us to do just that. The first reading, taken from the Book of Wisdom, is by far the most famous Old Testament passage used for funeral masses. And it helps us to look at death and beyond with the light of faith. It makes a huge contrast to those who look and live wisely and those with the worst biblical insult employable at the time, who were fools and looked at everything foolishly. Book of Wisdom says about the dead, "They seemed in the view of the foolish to be dead. Their passing away thought an affliction. Their going forth from us utter destruction." Foolish. This was the worst epithet that a Jew could hurl, because it meant that someone was looking at things not the way God sees them, through his revelation that he's helped those with faith to see, but to look at reality from an unreal prism. To those who do not look at things from God's perspective, the Book of Wisdom tells us the dead are simply dead. They're gone. They're decomposing. Their sufferings are just worthless afflictions leading to annihilation. There are many today whom we're going to serve who still look at suffering, death, and dying in the same foolish way. They believe there's no meaning to human suffering, and once someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness or is experiencing chronic pain, they believe that the only compassionate, humane response is to treat them the way we do our dogs. Put them out of their misery through physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. And then they often treat their mortal remains as anything but sacred, incinerating them the way we burn garbage, grinding the bones, and scattering them like chaff that the wind blows away. And all of that begins with the foolish way they view things. How do we look at death? And how do we learn from death how to look at life? You know, it's only through the perspective of looking at death with Christian eyes that we'll start to suck the marrow out of human existence. In Rome, there's a famous chapel run by the Capuchins. There's another in Vienna. There's another in Évora, Portugal, that are called bone churches, which are made entirely out of the decomposed skeletons of previous Franciscan Capuchin friars. And in one in Évora, Portugal, you have three friars hanging in the back of the chapel, one with a little sign saying 450 Anush, another 250, and the third 70. Then there's a little sign proclaiming in their body language the message that the Capuchins wanted them to learn. And this message has been placed on tombstones here, even in the United States. "Where you are," it says, "we once were. Where we are, one day you'll be. Memento mori." Remember that you will die and learn truly how to live. It's only when we recognize that we're born on death row, it's only when we grasp that today might actually be the last day of our life, that we begin to learn to live aright. Cardinal Regali wrote a beautiful letter 2 days before he retired as the Archbishop of Philadelphia that I don't know just how many people have read, but I think it's one of the deepest meditations ever on death. He was asking the priests of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia to make this every day. Make a meditation revolving around two thoughts of the Lord. First, John 10:18, "No one takes my life from me, I freely lay it down." And second, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. He says, if we make our morning offering with those two thoughts, if we come to Mass with those thoughts, if we pray the rosary with those thoughts, make our particular exam with those thoughts, and make our exam at the end of the day with those thoughts, then when death comes for us, even if it catches us humanly by surprise, we won't be spiritually caught off guard. Because we will have been able to say to the Lord, no one was taking my life, I wasn't letting it be wasted, I was making a choice of how to spend it every day, and I was spending it by placing it into the outstretched arms of the Father, into whom I was commending my spirit, my body, my whole life. And that's the wise way to live. And we see that in the Book of Wisdom. Those who live life and look at it with the eyes of faith see something different from the fools. They perceive, according to the Book of Wisdom, that the souls of the just, those who are in right relationship with the Lord, are in His hands and no torment shall touch them. They see further that even if they suffer, and we're all going to suffer, they suffer full of hope of immortality. They grasp that their chastisements become blessings in which God tests them as gold in the furnace, burning off the dross and impurity, so that in the time of their visitation they shall shine. It's the way those who are wise live. Those who look with Christian faith see all of these realities and more through the prism of Christ's own sufferings, through Christ's chastisements, through Christ's own death and resurrection. They recognize that their own Good Friday precedes Easter Sunday, that to experience the resurrection we must first endure the Passion, and that in our suffering, dying, death, and resurrection, Christ seeks to unite us to His own. It's a man who looks at the world this way who's worthy to have the 10 fingers descend. The passage finishes by reminding us, those who trust in God shall understand truth, and the faithful shall abide with Him in love, because grace and mercy are with God's Holy One, and His care is with His elect. The whole reading leads us to see whether we're looking and living foolishly or wisely, whether we're just in right relationship with God and others, whether we're trusting God, whether we really understand even the hard truths that He enunciates, whether we're abiding with Him in charity, because it's then we can not just receive a little, but be filled with His grace and mercy. And God promises to give us all the help He knows we need to live this type of life, but we have to make that persevering fiat to receive and respond to that holy gift. You can also view today's gospel with regard to the types of priests we're aspiring to be and that God wants us to aspire to be. We now live in an affirmation culture in which we're constantly trying to give everyone ribbons and awards and recognition, not principally for anything that they've earned, but just for showing up. This cultural shift is not altogether bad. In some ways, it's a helpful corrective to a highly competitive culture of yesteryear, where there was one winner and everyone else was considered losers. But Yogi Berra is now dead, and winning isn't necessarily the only thing. But to the members of the culture of Stuart Smalley's, the former star in Al Franken's Saturday Night Live daily affirmation skit, who used to repeat, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. To this culture of Stuart Smalley's, Jesus' words in the gospel almost seem cruel. Seems to be the exact opposite of this culture of affirmation. And we believe that if anyone is going to affirm us, it's going to be God. But we need to look hard at what Jesus is saying to us with the light of faith. The Lord gives us an image of a hardworking servant who has just come in from plowing the field and tending sheep. We can imagine the person's exhaustion. Jesus asks the person's boss, ask whether the person's boss, would typically say to him, "Come here and immediately take your place at table and proceed to wait on him." The obvious answer is no, of course not. Rather, Jesus says, he would say to him, "Prepare something for me to eat. Put on your apron and wait on me while I eat and drink. You may have your meal when I'm well done." To the culture of the time and to the culture of our time in many businesses, this way of treating employees, not to mention slaves, is standard. Jesus seems even to be affirming it. But he ups the ante with the moral he draws from the story. He asks, is he grateful to that servant because he did what was commanded? Implying that the answer is a definitive no. Then he says, so shall it be with you. When you've done all that you have been commanded, say, we're unprofitable servants who have only done what we've been obliged to do. Unprofitable servants. The same phrase in the Greek can be translated as useless. To our modern sensitive ears, it seems that Jesus is basically engaging in verbal abuse, saying that no matter how hard we work for him, no matter how hard we try, no matter how much we succeed, at the end of the day, we're just useless. And he implies that he isn't grateful for anything we've done, but that all we've done is what we're obliged to do and we should expect no thanks. I remember once being in a parish where the pastor refused to give thanks or recognition to parishioners, no matter how hard they worked. He canceled the parish's annual thank you dinner for volunteers. He stopped sending in a name to the bishop's office for the annual Marian medals, given each year to one dedicated parishioner per parish in a beautiful ceremony with the bishop of the cathedral. When the diocese instituted a St. Pius X award to recognize the dedicated sacrifices young people were making in their parishes, the pastor again refused to send any name in, memorably telling me when I asked him if we could send in this hardworking arch server's name. Kids don't need any encouragement. They need to remember what Jesus says in the gospel, that at the end of the day, they're just useless servants. He had interpreted Jesus' words literalistically, but missed their literal and true meaning. What point is Jesus making today? What point do we have to grasp and live? What point do we need to preach? It's not that God isn't grateful for our efforts, and that likewise we shouldn't be grateful for others' efforts. Jesus is trying to change our motivations in doing our work so that we would do it for the gospel, not do it for recognition, but out of love for God and others. During the Sermon on the Mount, with words we hear every Ash Wednesday, Jesus told us to pray, fast, and give alms, not so that others may see them. Because if that were our motivation, we would already be receiving our reward. He told us rather to do them with purity of intention, to do them for God, to do them out of love, promising that the Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward us. Jesus is not encouraging us to do good things to receive a reward in this life from the Father. Rather, he's encouraging us to do good things out of love for God and others, merely reminding us that the Father ain't blind. He sees our actions and our motivations. Will in fact remember and reward us all for what we do with proper motivation. He's also pushing us toward humility and gratitude. The Christian life is about serving rather than being served. And Jesus is calling us to seek to continue to serve even after a long day's work, even after a long week's work, after even 40 years in the vineyard, to work like those hardworking moms who continue to care for their families after long days at the office. And the Christian serves with the life, the talents, the energy that God has given. So our first response ought to be to thank God for these gifts, for the trust he's placed in us by giving us a share in his salvific mission. Yes, in one sense, we're useless servants, But he's given us all the help he knows we need so that we can prove to be good and faithful servants, who are no longer called servants but friends, and who will inherit as a reward the kingdom prepared since the foundation of the world. Is this what we're signing up for? Is this the intention we have? I remember as I was a transitional deacon preparing for priestly ordination, I received a letter from our vicar general. And in it was a long questionnaire about funeral plans, which is okay that I could take to my retreat. But right there on it, and I was 29 preparing for ordination, it asked me about my retirement plans. And I remember just writing down, ask me in 40 years. I have no idea. The last thing on my mind is to think about retirement. But in the priesthood today, there is this culture of retirement, where guys, if they can at 70, they just basically quit. Doesn't mean that they stop being a pastor and serve in some other capacity. No, they want to go minister to the people down on the beach in the golf course in Florida. It's not worthy of the Lord. Not worthy of the Lord. When we work hard, we deserve a Sabbath rest. Day off is very important for us to finish the marathon. Likewise, we don't always have to be taking the hardest assignments when we're getting older in years. But are we signing up to work hard in that vineyard to the extent of our level? Or are we basically approaching the priesthood the way so many approach their careers, as something that they need to do for a time before they have a time for a second childhood, for things far less serious than the salvation of others? I remember Cardinal Dolan once asked about a bishop I knew and asked if he had retired yet. And I said, yes, he retired last year. And he said, many of us at the conference thought that he had retired on the day of his ordination. Is that what people are going to say about us on the day of a priestly ordination? God hopes not. Jesus has come as our servant to free us from foolish ideas. And St. Leo, as a doctor of the church, wants us all to live wisely, particularly as priests. Pope Leo gives us his most famous words every Christmas morning that reminds us of what Christ has done and inspires us always to live in accordance with that gift. Christian, remember your dignity. After Christ has done so much and given you so much, remember your dignity and live in accordance with that dignity. And for us as priests, that means we're priests full time, all the way, until we see the eternal high priest whom we hold in our hands each day, face to face. Today, that high priest waits for us on this retreat day. He knew from before the foundation of the world that we would be making this day of recollection today. And he's come with graces prepared from that time to give us today, including the grace of a real holy resolution to learn from Leo the Great how to live as a good and faithful servant, and as a reward for us even on the way, he gives us a foretaste of heaven. Even though according to human logic no slave would ever be invited in from working the field to be served by his master, that's exactly what Jesus promises to do for us who serve him and others in this way. Just as Jesus put on an apron and washed the feet of the apostles during the Last Supper, Jesus promises that at the eternal wedding banquet, for which the Mass is a foretaste and a participation, those who have already been vigilant and working, he will seat us at table, gird himself with an apron and proceed to wait on them. And here he not only washes feet, but he feeds us with himself that strengthens us from the inside to live up to everything to which he calls us. Let us turn to St. Leo the Great and receive this gift and respond to intercede for us so that we might live this reality, receive the Lord's grace and mercy all the days of our life, and come to that eternal banquet where Christ is already vested, desiring to continue to serve us who have served him. Praise be Jesus Christ.